Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In May of 2012, feminist blogger and pop culture critic Anita Sarkeesian launched a Kickstarter campaign called Tropes Versus Women in Video Games.
In addition to being loads of fun to play, research has found that gaming can improve problem-solving skills, teamwork, creative thought, and multitasking. Unfortunately, in addition to all of these benefits, many games tend to reinforce and amplify sexist and downright misogynist ideas about women.
Anita asked for $6,000 to make a video series analyzing gender roles in video games. She raised the money in one day and eventually raised $158,000. The project's first video, Damsel in Distress Part 1, hit YouTube in March.
Princess Peach is in many ways the quintessential stock character version of the Damsel in Distress. The ill-fated princess appears in 14 of the core Super Mario Bros. Platformer games, and she's kidnapped in 13 of them.
Anita's success came at a disturbing price, however. She's been pelted with chauvinistic insults, sexual harassment, and even death threats made online. Attempts have been made to flag and pull her videos from YouTube, and her Wikipedia page was hacked and vandalized with pornographic images. The attack on Anita is just one of many displays of sexism that got us thinking about flagrant misogyny online. Does the anonymous nature of web culture encourage, attract, or even embolden hatred of women? What is the role of online communities and sites like Kickstarter or YouTube in preventing and challenging sexism online? Joining me to discuss these questions is NHPR's Brady Carlson. He's host of All Things Considered and our regular web culture analyst.
Hi, Virginia.
Maddie Myers is also with us. She's video game columnist for Paste Magazine. Hello, Maddie.
Hi.
And Jamin Warren returns to the program, founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen. That's a video game arts and culture company. Jamin, great to have you back.
Hello, how are you?
Jamin, I want to go to you first. Your perspective, please, on sexism and misogyny in video games in the industry. And are these stereotypes and tropes Anita's pointing out reflected more generally by gamers themselves?
It's obviously a big problem. And I think that that Anita's very brave for being someone to speak out and speak her mind. I think there are a couple issues at heart here. I mean, first and foremost is just the lack of gender diversity in the video game industry to begin with. I mean, if you go to a big video game conference like E3 or even one that's focused on game professionals like the Game Developers Conference, you know, it's 95% men and there's a couple women here and there. So, you know, it's no surprise then that you see a lot of these tropes appear in a lot of the output. And this is not something that video games alone struggle with. Obviously, Hollywood struggles with this. Publishing houses don't publish as many female authors as they do men. I mean, this is a problem across the board. But I think in particular for games, it's become a pretty serious issue. I don't necessarily think that it's one reflected by all gamers, if only because that term gamers really implies just about everyone now. I mean, half of American households have a video game console in their house. You look at platforms like the iOS, which tends to skew more heavily towards women. So I do think what happened was that Anita sort of shook a hornet's nest of a particular very loudmouth kind of quote-unquote gamer who didn't like what she was trying to say. And it's a real shame, and I think it definitely tarnishes the image of what it means to be someone who plays games.
Maddie, how about you? You're a female video game critic. Is there an incentive to write critically about video games if this is the sort of reaction one might look forward to?
I would say it's very difficult to do that, and I think that what has happened to Anita has been also felt by other female critics. There have been times when I've written about gender in games and have gotten a similar reaction, although on a smaller scale. Anita Sarkeesian's Kickstarter actually went viral, and she's become a target in some ways just because she's sort of a face of female game critics right now. I think that might just be her bad luck. There are very few female game critics in general, though, and also not very many women working in the games industry either.
Well, I'm also wondering if, as a video game critic, I mean, it's a particularly active and sometimes virulent community. Even if you're not talking about female roles, do you get sort of flamed for criticizing video games in general?
Yes, and I think one reason for that is that competition is socially coded as a masculine trait, and a lot of video games are about competition. And since video games rely on mental competition, theoretically everybody is equal. It's not like, say, a woman writing about professional sports or professional wrestling, which are also very difficult fields for women to approach from a journalistic perspective, the worst kinds of sexism come out in comments where people say that women mentally can't deal with playing StarCraft or playing fighting games or what have you. It's one thing if people talk about physical differences between men and women, but in video gaming comments in particular, people can talk about the more entrenched kind of misogyny, which is talking about mental differences between men and women, which I obviously don't think exist.
Brady, I'm wondering, we've seen opinion pieces condemning the misogynist reaction to Anita's project in The New Statesman and Wired and The Guardian, Slate, Salon, Jezebel, many, many other places. So how is the internet's reaction fueling or counteracting this kind of online display?
Well, oftentimes it's cyclical, and the way that Maddie described this particular instance going viral is a key component of why things have played out the way they have. I mean, part of it is just the architecture of the web now. It's very easy to post. You can often still do so anonymously. And the fact that we are not really in front of each other makes the web depersonalizing in a way. So for some people, they may see it as this is, you know, just a person on a screen, a character that's not going to read what I write. So I'm just yelling back at the screen. At the same time, there's also the community momentum, which is especially strong in these tight-knit communities like around gaming or around a particular sport. The net effect is that one person, an Anita Sarkeesian, may stand up, but it's harder and harder to stand up against hundreds and sometimes thousands of people.
Mm. Well, actually, Brady, I think it runs even deeper than that. I mean, if you look at the legal framework around sites that publish content, you know, they're not held responsible for things that are posted there. So if you're Facebook or you're Reddit, you're not necessarily incentivized to flag something that's a problem until someone brings it to your attention, with the exception of child pornography. And so particularly with hate speech, I mean, we've set up a framework where if I'm starting a new website where someone can publish whatever it is that they want, I don't necessarily have to put in safeguards to ensure that members of that community behave in a way that's respectful of others. And it's very strange because you're ending up with these sort of digital nation states. I mean, you know, there are a billion people that use Facebook. There are hundreds of millions of people who use sites like YouTube, for example. These are small, these are countries. These are, you know, large populations of people who don't necessarily have the, you know, social or cultural framework in which they should think about what they say online as having any kind of public ramifications.
Jamin Warren, founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen, also with us today, Brady Carlson, and Maddie Myers, a video game columnist for Pace Magazine. We're talking about online misogyny, whether the web forum itself encourages it or emboldens it. Is the tide turning or is it just getting worse? Another offensive element was added to the mix in recent weeks, a Kickstarter project called Above the Game. Here's a clip from the launch video.
I'm Ken Howinski. I want to thank you for checking out my Kickstarter project today. I am raising funds to publish a book that I've written. It's called Above the Game, and it is a guide for men to get better with women. When I was a kid, you know, I was a nerd. You know, I'm not afraid to say it. I spent a lot of time on my computer. I had a BBS when I was 12.
Okay, sounds harmless enough, maybe a little undermatured. But during the campaign, a blogger discovered chapters of the proposed book on Reddit and included some very disturbing language, most of it unfit for radio, I must say, encouraging readers to pressure, assault, and some argued rape women. Now, after the project was funded, Kickstarter issued an apology through their blog and said, "We're sorry for getting this so wrong," and prohibited seduction guides in the future, saying that these things do not belong on Kickstarter. Finally, they donated $25,000 to RAIN, an anti-sexual violence organization. Maddie, what do you think about the action Kickstarter took in this case? Was it enough, or is it even up to Kickstarter to be the watchdog when the whole point of crowdfunding is to let people decide what's worth funding?
I think it is absolutely Kickstarter's job to be the watchdog in this instance because they are a private company and there are other ways to do crowdfunding on one's own website if one wanted to do so. But Kickstarter is a brand and they have to think about what their brand represents. I do think they did the right thing in apologizing, but they say that they got complaints about the seduction guide a couple hours before it ended, but that wasn't enough time for them to put a stop to the Kickstarter. And now Ken Howinski did end up getting, I believe, about $15,000. Although I appreciate their apology, I question why it is that they were unable to stop this if they truly did not think that it was the right thing to fund.
Brady, we've also seen social media sites like YouTube or Facebook criticized for not being able to better moderate comments. What do you think their responsibility is?
Well, I think it comes back to something that Jamin said. Up until now, the guiding principle that companies have used has simply been the law. There may be a sense that the tech industry is now growing so huge and influential that we need to start thinking about what it means to be good citizens. If we have these nation states, what does it mean to be a good nation? What I think is really important in this particular case is that the community not only pointed out this flaw, but people across the web started speaking out about it directly. Up until now, we as community members have relied on that report this button that's at the bottom of videos and Facebook posts and tweets to police it and figure the moderators need to do the rest. But I wonder if that simply just drives that kind of content underground and doesn't really change the dynamic of the conversation. Maybe it would take a more direct kinds of conversations where people are confronting people who are doing misogynist things or posting misogynist projects to say, this is not simply something we need to delete. It's something that we need to confront and change.
Brady, you're right. I think it's good to see companies like Kickstarter take a more active role and not just ask this question, you know, do we want people to come to our site, but what kind of people do we want those visitors to be? How should they think about their engagements with that website? I do think it's worth noting that, you know, a lot of these startups are, and Kickstarter is a notable exception in that they actually hire a lot of women there. They actually have like a pretty healthy gender ratio at that company. But a lot of other, you know, tech startups, that's not the case. And I think it's not surprising at all that you do have websites that are, you know, predominantly created by men and that they don't necessarily think about these communal concerns. Like, what can we do to protect people who maybe don't have the same kind of voice in the public square that we do?
Well, you are all talking about sexism on the web being reflective of sexism in society at large. And I've been hearing a lot of conversations about the summer movie menu with very, very few female leads. So they're sort of reinforcing the idea that sexism sells. How is that manifesting?
I think it's definitely a chicken and egg problem in that, you know, you create a system that perpetuates itself. So you don't produce any types of media that have strong female leads. And then when you do, it doesn't do as well as maybe you hope because you didn't give it the marketing support that required. And so the cycle continues and continues and continues. So, I do think in the case of games in particular, that there does need to be a very, very big shift in terms of who we think plays games and what people are definitely interested in. And at the end of the day, you know, unfortunately, I think people do need to speak with their wallet and make sure that they're supporting things that they think advance values that are good for everyone.
Well, Anita Sarkeesian makes the point that she plays these games. They can be wonderfully interactive and social and interesting to play. Last word to you, Maddie. Do you think the fundamental change is with the makers?
I do think that. And I think that some of those changes are happening, to end it on a lighter note. If you look at the best-selling top five games recently in 2013, Tomb Raider is one of them. They recently created a sort of redux of the Tomb Raider image in which Lara Croft is a bit more human seeming and not a performative supermodel type, more of a human being, as it were. And another game that's been very popular this month is The Last of Us, which, although it doesn't star a playable female character, it includes several female characters who all seem like human beings as opposed to caricatures. And I've appreciated seeing that. And those are games that have been big blockbusters, very popular games. So I think things are getting better. And I do think that the onus is on these bigger companies, these bigger journalistic outlets, and Kickstarters even, to decide who they want their audience to be and who they want to feel safe within these spaces. Do they want to make them a safe space for misogynists, or do they want to make them a safe space for everybody else?
Maddie Myers, video game columnist for Pace Magazine, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jamin Warren, founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen. Jamin, thanks again.
No problem. Take care.
Brady Carlson, great to have you with us, NHPR's host of All Things Considered and Word of Mouth web culture analyst. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You can find a link to Anita Sarkeesian's video series, Tropes versus Women in Video Games, as well as reactions to her online harassment and Kickstarter's apology for the Above the Game project. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think. Has the web created, attracted, or maybe intensified misogynistic thinking and content? Do you feel it's your duty to stand up to that kind of content? Or if you've been the victim of online misogyny, what have you done to cope with it or counteract it? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth, and we promise to carefully and respectfully moderate the comments. More than 2 years have passed since the day that gamers remember as Black Friday. That's when the Department of Justice raided and shut down three major American online gambling websites, charged site executives with bank fraud, and seized billions of dollars in winnings. Since then, social gaming from Zynga and Dollar Down Casino have been thriving on social media sites, attracting millions of players to their digital tables using only fake money. At the same time, real money gambling is back on the internet. On April 30th, Station Casinos in Nevada became the first site to offer real online poker since the 2011 shutdown. The question is whether the for-profit sites will draw millions of social players and whether the strictly social gamers will put real money on the line. Michael Kaplan is contributing editor for Cigar Aficionado magazine and has been covering the return of online gambling. Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What did online gamblers do after the shutdown?
There are still places where you could play. I mean, there are some offshore sites where you can play online poker, but getting your money onto them is like really difficult. Collecting money is really difficult. And the players on there tend to be pretty good because they're players who kind of went through a lot of trouble to get their money on there. So some people played on there. Some people played live. Some people left the United States. I mean, serious online poker players who made a lot of money. I mean, I know a lot of guys who moved to Vancouver, you know, moved to Australia, or, you know, moved to live wherever they wanted to live where they could play online poker legally.
And meanwhile, sites like Zynga and Double Down Casino, these free, fun, completely legal sites accessible via Facebook, loaded millions of players. So why play with no money at stake?
To be honest with you, I'll never quite understand, like, why you would play poker if you can't make money, because one of the things is if there's no money at stake, like why would you not just put in all your chips with any hand? I mean, I honestly don't get it, but a lot of people love it. I mean, it's super popular, and these companies, you know, they make their money because a tiny, tiny percentage, I think it's like maybe 1-2% of the people who play on there will pay money to buy extra, you know, funny money chips.
So now that Zynga and Double Down, for example, have had so much time to develop their games online through these social media sites, is there any kind of relationship between casinos hoping to cash in online and drawing in those social media players?
It's interesting because the people who play online poker for free are apparently not the same as the people who play for money. They're not sure if they can convert those people over. I spoke with somebody from Caesars when I was working on the story, and I mean, he said that they don't see their business being to convert the play money players because they have like a very robust play money site, like where you can play all the casino games online for fake money. And, you know, for them, it's a promotional tool and it kind of keeps people engaged in the games they have. The other interesting thing is, you know, having an online site for money and having an online site for free are really two completely different things. Because when you have an online site for money, it's almost like having online banking because, I mean, there are a ton of security issues. There are issues also, you know, of running it, of keeping in touch with your customers, keeping people incentivized to keep playing and the marketing. I mean, it really are, they really are two completely different businesses. Mm-hmm.
How about the former following for the real online gambling? The figures I saw, 76 bank accounts frozen across 14 countries, billions of dollars in winning. What is going to incentivize those who got so stung to come back to this rejuvenated, suddenly legal online gaming format?
I think they'll come back. I mean, I think, look, if it's being done totally legally and there's a casino behind it, it takes away a lot of the worry. I would have no problem putting money in there and expecting them to pay me back. The only problem is you have to be in Nevada to play. You cannot be outside of the state and play. So another question is, like, how many people want to come to Nevada, you know, as tourists at least, and play online poker when there's lots of poker that you can play live? Mm-hmm. The other question is, like, the liquidity. These sites had a ton of players, and there was a ton of money, and there were a ton of games. I used to like playing on Full Tilt, and there was a particular tournament I liked to play. And I'd play 8 of them at a time, and they would load up really fast. And I would just sit there on 2 monitors and multi-table, and it was so much fun. But you can't do that unless there's, like, I don't know what the number is, but there have to be tens of thousands of players for games to load that quickly. And that's just not happening. That's not going to happen if it's only legal in one state.
Well, Michael Kaplan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Kaplan, contributing editor for Cigar Aficionado magazine, where he's been covering casinos and gaming. You can link to read his article, Virtual Poker Goes Viral, at wordofmouthradio.org.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with the gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns staring out the window at the darkness. Till boredom overcame us and he began to speak. He said, son, I've made my life out of reading people's faces and knowing what their cards were by the way they held their...
Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. There is nothing more tempting than a day off spent soaking up the sun on a hot beach with a good read. Summer reads don't have to be mindless, though. Michelle Filgate is a testament to that. We turn to her to find the perfect book for every occasion, and she's not afraid to add some substance, some old, some new, to the usually light fare offered by beach blanket lists. Michelle is a writer, book critic, and independent bookseller at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Great to have you back with us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So let's start with a traditional beach read. Any must-read page-turner for the summer?
Yes, I actually want to recommend something by an author who I've talked about on the show before. His name is Rick Yancey, and he writes a lot of young adult books. And his newest book is called The Fifth Wave. It's the first in a trilogy set in a world where aliens have attacked, and no one knows who's an alien and who's a human anymore. The main character is a girl who is separated from her brother and determined to be reunited with him. And it has a love story. I like to compare it to The Hunger Games and to Ender's Game. And it already got a huge movie deal. It's going to be a big deal. And it's a book that you just cannot put down as soon as you start reading.
So another post-apocalyptic YA novel. What sets this one apart?
Rick Yancey is an incredible writer, so it's not just a really good plot, but he's a good storyteller, and we are inundated with a lot of post-apocalyptic books, but this one is a must-read.
Why do you think summer reading is so often associated with the page-turners, with entertaining books, sort of checking out your mind?
I think it's because most people, you know, want an escape and to zone out on their summer vacation or on the beach. And I completely get that. But, you know, I'm all for reading books for escapism as well, as indicated by the book I just picked. But I also think that, you know, wintertime isn't the only time of year to read brainier books and books that, you know, you won't see on most summer reading lists. I find that, you know, when you're in the sun, you can read a darker book and it's okay because the sun is out and it's nice outside and the world seems okay and it's not dark and dreary.
All right. So how about some of those brainier books we often turn to you for? Any titles you want to recommend?
Okay, so there's a book I just read that I am crazy over the moon about, and I want to get everyone to read. It was published by a small press called Coffee House Press, and it's called Submergence by J.M. Ledgard. It's a story about a man and a woman who meet on the French coast and have a romance. But then at the same time, it's flash forwarding to later when the man, who is a spy, is being held by Somali terrorists, while the woman, who's a biomathematician and obsessed with the microbes in the deepest part of the ocean, is studying that and preparing to submerge into the ocean. And this is a book that's really about the language. There are just some incredible sentences. Like, I want to read this one quote where he says, "We want to know what is in the sky and what is behind the sky. These have been our obsessions since our beginnings, yet the curiosity does not extend to the ocean. We forget there is so much darkness in our world, and to be out on a beach is to be lucky."
All right, how about another beachy read?
So another read by someone named Matt Bell, who I'm friendly with, he wrote this book called In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods. Try saying that 10 times fast. But it's astoundingly beautiful. You know, his sentences are like incantations. My boyfriend, who's also a book critic, rightly described it as a combination between Cormac McCarthy and Angela Carter. And
wow.
I have to agree with him. I think that that's the highest praise you can give a book. And what it is it's a creation myth. It's a man and a woman who are living in this house and trying to have children. And, you know, it goes wrong. And the father swallows this foundling who's swimming inside of him and kind of trying to turn him against his wife as they continue to try to have children. And there's a bear and there's a squid. And so there's a lot of mythology going on in this book. The wife sings a moon into existence and sings rooms beneath the house into existence. And it's terrifying at parts. And it's also just gorgeous prose. I want to read the whole book aloud because it's beautiful to read aloud.
I'm going to try and say that title, In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods by Matt Bell.
Yes.
All right, turning the page to nonfiction, any recommendations there?
So an author we have both talked about on the show before, Kate Christensen. She's
right,
one of my
Epicure's Lament.
Writers. Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And that was my favorite book by her before I read this. And now tying with it is her brand new memoir that's coming out this summer called Blue Plate Special. I think it started, she was writing and she has been writing a blog where she shares personal essays and then incorporates recipes with those essays. And in this book, it's very much a book about how food has shaped her life. She's an incredible cook herself. And in all of her novels, her characters are obsessed with food. And so this is a book where we get to see what Kate's obsession with food comes from and also how food has nourished her.
There's another book on your nonfiction list that I'm really looking forward to. It sounds like it's going to be the kind of kitchen confidential of the elite publishing world.
I think that's a fantastic comparison, actually. It's called Hot House by Boris Kochka. He writes for New York Magazine. He has a lot of insider scoop. And it's all about FSG, which is one of the most important publishers of all time. You know, they're the ones who have published Jonathan Franzen and Susan Sontag, and it goes on and on. But this book is a gossipy and frothy tale of the founding of this publisher up until the present time. So you really see the evolution of a publishing house. And I think it was Juno Diaz who blurbed it and compared it to Mad Men. And I think that people who, you know, like Mad Men will enjoy this book. There's even a scene where you hear about two women who are sleeping with one of the publishers who go shopping together to get matching bathrobes so that he feels comfortable when he goes home during his lunch. You just can't even imagine this stuff happened.
But. Right. Who knew the publishing world could be so juicy? Now, this is Farrar, yeah. Straus, and Giroux is FSG?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So that's Hot House by Boris Kochka. You've got another book that is quite a throwback. I guess one of the first confessional diaries ever published. Tell us about I Await the Devil's Coming.
Yes, it's by Mary McLean, and this was originally published in 1902, and it basically conveys the thoughts of a 19-year-old girl who lives in Montana. It's incredibly narcissistic and raw, but it's also riveting. When the book was originally published, it apparently sold 100,000 copies, and I can definitely see why, because it was shocking for the time. She talks about her sexuality and her desires, and, you know, there's this one quote that kind of sums up that I just want to read, where she says, Fame may pass over my head. Money may escape me. My one friend may fail me. Every hope may fold its tent and steal away. Happiness may remain a sealed book. Every remnant of human ties may vanish. I may find myself an outcast. Good things held out to me may suddenly be withdrawn. The stars may go out one by one. The sun may go dark. Yet still I may hold upright my head if I have but my steak and my onions. So this is a book that's very much about a girl's desires, whether it's, you know, sexual or food. And I think that it's a book that really opened up the ability for contemporary memoirs as they are. And so it's a really fascinating look at this girl in the 1900s.
Mary MacLean's I Await the Devil's Coming. That is one of the nonfiction recommendations from Michelle Philgate. She's an independent bookseller, a writer herself, and a book critic. And she's bringing us through some summertime book suggestions that you may not find at the top of the pack in your local bookstore. But that's why we turn to her. Michelle, you mentioned earlier that we can afford to read books about darker subjects in the summer. And you have a couple of books about loneliness on the list. Why should we read a sad book in the summer?
Because it's, you know, why not? Some of the best books that are written, you know, are about the incredible sadness of being a human and what we go through every day. And two of my favorite books that I've read this year, actually, I read back to back, and they both have similar themes about loneliness in them, even though they're very different. The first one is called Turtle Diary by Russell Hoban. New York Review of Books Classics just reissued this, and it originally came out in the 1970s. You might recognize the name Russell Hoban because he's also the beloved children's author who wrote Bread and Jam for Francis and many other books. But this book is very different. It's about a man who's a bookseller and a woman who's a children's writer. And they both become obsessed with the idea of the turtles in the zoo. And they want to release these turtles. And it goes back and forth between their viewpoints. And, you know, both of them are middle-aged and dealing with their own disappointments in their lives. There's a lot of sadness in this book, but there's also a lot of beauty. And I kept underlining almost every sentence, and I quoted a lot on my blog. And I just thought that it's slim, but packs a punch. And then right after that, I read The Illusion of Separateness by Simon Van Boy, who's a Welsh author. And I had always meant to read his books. I've heard very good things about his previous works. But now that I read this novel, I need to read everything he has written because he reminds me of a modern day Hemingway, but a Hemingway with more heart. His prose is really stark, but he's able to say so much in so few words. Like there's one sentence where he says, "Every day is a masterpiece, even if it crushes you." Mm. And this book is all centered around people whose lives are connected all because of a baby who is saved during World War II. And some of the characters are lonely people. There's a character in this book who's a blind girl who yearns for love, and another who's a caretaker at a nursing home. And when I got to the last chapter of this book, I kind of do a bad thing where I walk in while I'm reading in New York City, which is very dangerous. But when I'm reading a good book, I just can't put it down. And I was standing outside of a restaurant on a sidewalk in New York, a crowded sidewalk, and I just started weeping during this last chapter. Just didn't even care. So when a book makes you cry in public, you know that it's good.
Well, that's pretty high praise. There are a couple of other books on Michelle's list that we won't be able to get to. Those are of the pop culture genre, but it's not that we disparage them. It's just that we don't have time for all so many books. Isn't that just the problem with summer? Michelle Philgate is a writer, book critic, and independent bookseller at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks, Virginia.
Now, you can find a list and more on all the books that Michelle mentioned here at wordofmouthradio.org. Here in New Hampshire, we have only 18 precious miles of coastline. But on both coasts, even California, with its miles of beaches, battles over public access to waterfronts have led to heated debates over just who the beach belongs to. Jenny Price is an environmental writer who's been fighting for more open public access to Malibu's beaches. She co-created an app, Our Malibu Beaches, with developer Ben Adair. It aims to show where the public can access parts of the California coast, often claimed by beachfront property owners. Jenny Price, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
And Ben, nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So Jenny, what spurred you into action on this project?
Well, I just care deeply about public space in Southern California. Southern California is a place where it's really notorious for not having good public spaces, but the beach is the big exception. The beach is one of the few places that really operates like, you know, a Central Park or a Golden Gate Park or something. But there are places along the California coast that are blocked off. By law, they can't be blocked off, but there are a lot of places that are, and probably the big hot spot on the California coast is Malibu. And that's 27 miles of coast. It's a quarter of the beachfront in the L.A. area, and it's right next to a huge metropolitan area. Mm. And 20 of those miles are walled off by private development and are actually very difficult to get to.
So just clarify for me, culturally or legally, does everybody have rights to the beachfront?
So in California, the law is that everything up to what's called the mean high tide line belongs to the public. Essentially what that translates into is that you can walk on the wet sand on any beach in California.
Do property owners in California have legal standing when they try to keep the public off of the beach if they're up above that line?
Well, they have made all kinds of legal arguments, but no, they don't, and that's been upheld. Legally, it's incontrovertible that the public owns the land below the mean high tide line. The problem is that you can't get to it. There aren't access ways. You know, once you get down there, there's signs that tell you you can't be there. Sometimes there's security guards. It's hard to park. They block off the parking spaces. Even the lands, the places where there are access ways, it can be very difficult to even use the beach in those places.
Okay, Ben, how did you get drawn into this?
Well, can I add something to what Jenny's saying?
But sure.
There are private parts of beaches all up and down California. And so one of the things that gets really problematic for people trying to use the beaches, especially in Malibu, is understanding where the public part is and where the private part is. And that's one of the things that we really wanted to clarify with this app, too, is that it's as much about respecting public property as it is about respecting private property. And so now, with this app that we've developed, people can really just go out and know exactly which parts of the beach they can use, and everybody can just have a great day.
Yeah, that's what we wanted to know. What does the app actually do?
Sure. So it's basically based on a map, so that you open the app on your phone, and it guides you to each of the different access ways in Malibu. And then when you get down on the beach, it walks you down each beach house by house and says, okay, here you can use all the dry sand up to the property. Here you can use all the dry sand within 25 feet of the property. Here you can only use the wet sand.
Okay, so how did you discover all these access points? Was there an army of beachcombers or finders?
No, I mean, it's very, very difficult. Very few people know where they are. When I first started doing this issue 10 years ago, there were only a couple places where you could find them, and one was the surfer sites, and the other was the star stalking sites. So I'd look on these star stalking sites, and then I'd have to, you know, basically, like, take a shower after I did that. And I sort of very slowly figured out where all the access ways are. That was when I would just sit on the phone for days with the Coastal Commission, who had all this information about exactly where these access ways are. And, you know, it's basically blocking public access by lack of information. And that's where I think an app can be this really, really great tool. And actually, Escape Apps approached me and said, you know, we think this could be a really great use for, you know, the information that you've accumulated over the years.
Escape Apps, what do you normally do, Ben, that this would appeal to you or you would go after it?
Yeah, sure. So we specialize in making these types of local discovery apps with information that's really hard to come by, stuff that's not on the internet, that's not anywhere really available. So for us, for me, like I'm a longtime journalist. I've been a reporter and editor for, gosh, 20 years now. And so this is really the next step, I think, in journalism. Like, it's not just writing about access issues or maybe putting a PDF on a website somewhere. Like, this is allowing people, through these great mobile tools that we have, giving them really a chance to go out and explore and discover and participate in stories as they happen, which that's what we do at Escape App. So when I saw Jenny's, you know, previous writings about this, I thought, wow, this is great. This is totally useful information. It's a great issue. And in the end, it's all about just going out and having a great day at the beach. And who doesn't want to have that?
Well, it is your front yard if you are a big celebrity that people stalk these celebrities at some times. I mean, isn't right. there some argument that could be made that you don't necessarily want people walking across, you know, where you're out sunbathing?
I understand that completely. I have a lot of sympathy with them. The paparazzi are horrible, and they all hang out in Malibu. If you're a celebrity and you need a buffer zone, then you should not be buying a house right next to really significant public lands. Look, most people in Los Angeles and in Malibu live next to public space. We live next to streets, to sidewalks. You know, the problem is that they have to understand that they live next to public space. It's exactly the same as if you live next to a public park. You know, to my mind, having covered and looked at the history of what's gone down on there a lot, there are violations of private property that happen down there, but honestly, I think they pale in comparison to the violations of public property that have gone on down there.
So while many people consider Malibu to be terminally unique in its needs, this access to beachfront property goes on in a lot of places. I've heard of it definitely down on the Cape. Any thoughts of doing it for other areas?
Sure. We've gotten a ton of people writing us. Either, you know, they find out about the app through the Kickstarter that we did, or just, you know, we were on Good Morning America. The issue's really gone all over the world, really, and we've gotten people writing in from Massachusetts, all over New England. The laws are really esoteric, having to do with fishing rights, sometimes going back to the colonial period, and people want to know, where can we use the beaches here? People in Florida, there was even somebody from Lebanon who wrote in about public access to Lebanese beaches, which I don't know anything about, but we would love to take it. We would love to take it national. We'd love to take it international.
Days at the beach for everybody.
Summer is here, finally.
Gotta keep those loving good vibrations are happening with her. Gotta keep those loving good.
That's Ben Adair. He's a longtime journalist, public radio producer, and now app developer with Escape. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jenny Price is an environmental writer who's been fighting for more public access to Malibu's 27 miles of beach. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
They're co-creators of the app Our Malibu Beaches. You can find more about the app at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. For the past 53 years, rest areas have offered weary travelers a place to pull off and pause and maybe even learn a little local history. Traditional rest areas are quickly disappearing from the nation's roadways. Louisiana, for example, has already closed 24 of his 34 stops. Ryan Ford is a photographer whose work has been featured in the New York Times and the Texas Monthly, among other places. And she has been trying to capture these doomed rest areas with her cameras before they disappear. Her project is called Rest Stops, Vanishing Relics of the American Roadside. And she joins us now from KUT in Austin. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So first of all, Ryan, what do you mean by traditional rest areas? I guess you're not talking about, you know, the Starbucks, Gas Up, Burger King kind of big pull off the sideway rest areas, right?
What I focused my photography project on was the true highway rest areas, such as roadside tables, picnic areas. They were started all the way back in the 30s, during the Great Depression, actually, when people would travel for days and weeks at a time. And they were created just out of sheer necessity. People would need a place to pull over and rest. Driving was really tiring back in those days. And they would just kind of look for a wide spot on the road and pull over and sometimes pick fruit off of farmers' trees. They'd milk their cows. They'd knock on the door and, you know, ask for supplies. And then later on, back in 1956, when the interstate highway system was developed, that's when safety rest areas were officially created. They were an element of the highway system. They were very official. those were what people more traditionally think of rest stops. They have the bathrooms and you walk your dog, read the map and look at the informational kiosks and stuff like that.
Some of your photographs are just a little shelter with just one lone picnic table or just one lone sort of pull-off spot. And these all look like they've been around for a very long time. I'm curious how you got interested in this. You sound young to me. Are you a frequent rest stop visitor?
I actually moved to Austin, Texas about 6 years ago from Los Angeles. And of course, we had the giant interstate rest areas along the different freeways and highways in California. And I always grew up with them, but I never really noticed them until I moved to Texas. Being a freelance photographer, I would drive around Texas on various commercial assignments, and I'd sometimes be on these different back roads, and I'd start to notice these cute little roadside tables. I really appreciate mid-century architecture and roadside culture, and I would just notice that a lot of them looked really old, like they were built in the mid-century. A lot of them were really fun and quirky. Some of them were shaped like a teepee. Some of them were shaped like a windmill or an oil derrick or wagon wheels. I really just didn't notice them until I moved to Texas, and I really started to take notice and thought that it might be really fun to do a photo project on them.
I read in your artist statement that you consider these rest stops as providing historical and cultural significance to the regions that built them. How so?
When the interstate system was built, it bypassed a lot of the smaller towns. It also bypassed a lot of the local flavor and a lot of the local culture. The engineers and designers of these different rest areas would actually design them to give travelers a window into what the local flavor and local culture was. For example, you know, if you were traveling through Texas or North Dakota or Oklahoma, obviously that's stereotypical, you know, Indian land. So they would build teepees. Or, you know, up in North Texas, they would, you know, cover the tables with oil derricks and windmills. And, you know, out in West Texas, they'd use wagon wheels and stuff like that.
Do you have a favorite rest stop?
Probably my best rest area story is I was actually headed home from Marfa, Texas, which is out in West Texas. It's a pretty artsy town. And we were driving home and stopped somewhere near Fort Stockton, which is pretty much the middle of nowhere of West Texas. I had my camera set up on a tripod shooting my rest area, and I see a trailer pull up that was covered in University of Texas logos. And as you know, sports fans can be pretty intense. So I just kind of snicker to myself and I go back to shooting. Through my viewfinder, I look up again and there are some people walking a longhorn through the rest area, which is hilarious. And
a longhorn cow.
Yeah, longhorn cow through the rest area on a leash. It was two handlers. It was so funny, and I had no idea why. So I'm like, laugh it off and go back to shooting. And then all of a sudden, my friends put two and two together and realized that it was actually Bevo, who's, you know, the famous University of Texas mascot. And they were actually coming home from winning the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California. I wandered up to them and asked them if I could get a shot of Bevo in my rest area. And sure enough, they kind of, you know, looked at me strangely, but I got the shot, and it's pretty great.
Were any of the sites you visited particularly well-maintained or very busy or populated? The ones in your photographs look kind of desolate.
You know, I purposely shoot them to look very desolate. You know, there are still quite a few along the main interstates that are still pretty well used. People really just pull over to use the restroom. A lot of people walk their dogs, and a lot of semi-truck drivers, you know, take naps there. But it's definitely the ones along the biggest interstates. The ones that are really not used anymore are along the smaller highways or in areas where there are lots of commercial options.
Although you're looking at these as relics, are there instances where you understood, you know, looking at the cracked concrete or crumbling infrastructure, that you understood why the choice was made to rope off or close off these sites?
I guess it was pretty obvious at a bunch of them why they were no longer used anymore. You know, they're at the very next exit, or sometimes the same exit, there'd be a brand new McDonald's or a brand new Buc-ee's that offers every possible amenity you could ever think of. And, you know, why pull over here when you can, you know, have every possible need at your fingertips?
Then what is your goal then when capturing these locations with your camera lens? Is this, you know, purely about raising awareness? Is this purely about saying goodbye to something? What is it for you?
I think my main goal with this project is to just create an archive of these because it's obvious that they're not going to be around forever. I mean, they're disappearing at a rate that's beyond belief. So basically, my main goal is to just systematically document them before they're gone forever. My dream for the project ultimately is to assemble the collection into a book because soon these images will be the only artifact that remains of this roadside culture.
Ryan Ford, a freelance photographer. Her work has been featured in the New York Times and Texas Monthly, among other places. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
We have a link to see her collection of photographs. Really worthwhile. It's called Rest Stops, Vanishing Relics of the American Roadside. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
If you ever plan to motor west.
Thank you so much for joining us today for a few stories that aroused our curiosity. If you liked what you heard, drop us a line. Or if you're the sharing kind, you can post links to our content on your Facebook page or on Twitter, or email them along to friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of
New Hampshire Public Radio.
Boston, San Bernardino, won't you get hip to this timely tip? When you make that California trip, get your kicks on Route 66.